Now, though, we turn to another subject that's confounded biologists for years. Why bats in the eastern U.S. are dying out so severely from something called white nose syndrome, and why their otherwise super immune systems aren't helping them with white nose. And by the way, although many people think bats are creepy, those who study them like to point out their benefit to humankind due to their voracious appetite for insects. One leading bat scientist estimates that for every 1 million bats which die out prematurely from white nose, almost 700 tons of insects go uneaten every summer. So with that in mind, we are talking now with Kevin Olival. He's a senior research scientist and bat expert with Eco Health Alliance. And Kevin, thank you very much for being with us. We really appreciate it.
Thanks for having me, Laura.
Well, so here's the confusing part, Kevin. At the same time, we hear about bats being decimated by this fungus, and we've been talking about this for a couple years here in New England. There is new research on the amazing immune systems bats have when it comes to other illnesses. So what are we learning right now about bats' stellar ability to ward off other diseases that other mammals, including humans, fall prey to?
Sure. Yeah, it's a fascinating area. There really is. It's a bat immunology, as I call it, is a very emerging field. And so a lot of people are interested in what allows these animals. And by the way, bats are this extremely diverse group, over 1,200 species of bats in the world, about 20% of all the mammals in the world. And so bats as a group tend to carry a fairly large number of viruses that we know of, including things like SARS, Ebola virus is likely linked to bats, and a number of other viruses that, of course, kill humans but don't kill the bats. And this relationship we see is actually fairly typical with a number of what we call wildlife disease reservoirs. So these are the natural hosts that carry that disease. And so bats, like some rodents also with hantaviruses and other viruses that people can die from, carry these viruses but don't get sick. But there's been a lot of really interesting research on bats, particularly that are saying, well, are bats really more special than other mammals? And if you think about bats, the one thing that really differentiates them from all other mammals is that they fly.
Right.
So they're the only group of mammals capable of self-powered flight. And because of that, there are some really interesting theories and hypotheses that link this idea of flight with how their immune system may be different. So when bats wake up in the evening time and they go out to go forage and go find insects and fly around, they ramp up their basal metabolic rate. So they essentially start flapping their wings, their whole body heats up. And so some of our colleagues have this theory that basically every night they have a big fever. And fever is a natural response to help your body deal with pathogens and viruses. You know, when you get the flu, you get a fever, well, that's a way of helping to knock down those virus particles. And so maybe bats are just going through this sort of regular fever every night. And on top of that, they seem to have maybe some ways to help repair the damage that comes with that big boost in your metabolic rate, these little molecules called free radicals that will destroy your cells and kind of link to chain reactions.
Right, link to the aging process. Yeah, go ahead.
Yeah, absolutely. So there's some ideas that maybe bats have a better response to deal with those free radicals than some of their hosts.
Well,
so it's an intriguing area, for sure.
Yeah, and lots to untangle here. And Jeff Foster is also with us. He's an assistant professor of genetics at UNH. His research focus includes bats and white nose syndrome. And Jeff Foster, welcome to you, too. Thanks for your time.
Hi, Laura. Thank you.
Well, and as you heard, Kevin's been telling us about just the amazing immune system that bats have, and we'll get into that in a minute. But here's the big question that I had looking at the information. If bats, you know, don't get Ebola, they don't get SARS, they don't get cancer, they live much, much longer than mammals similar to them in size. Why are they so devastated by white nose syndrome, Jeff? Why don't their superstellar immune systems help them fight white nose?
Yeah, so I'd say with the blizzard raging outside, it really is remarkable to think that our bats of the region are hunkered down in these caves, hibernating and waiting out the winter. And so what they typically do is they enter into hibernation, and their immune systems are largely on a low simmer or off. And so in many ways, they're not prepared for any pathogen that may be able to attack them in the winter. And in fact, many pathogens, nearly all pathogens, have to have fairly warm temperatures to enable to survive. One exception is the tongue-twisting fungus that causes white nose syndrome called Pseudogymnoascus destructans. And so, as you talked about before, it has caused the deaths of over 6 million bats since it was first observed in New York State in 2006. And so what this fungus is able to do is able to attack the bats in midwinter when their immune systems are most vulnerable because they're essentially turned off.
I see. So, and I have read about how it attacks them during hibernation, wakes them up basically when they shouldn't be woken up, and then they lose their fat stores. Is that right, Jeff?
Yes, that's exactly right. And so they have a fairly generous amount of fat in their bodies that enables them to get through the winter. But what's happening now is that the fungus is disturbing the bats so much, the fungus is actually growing into the skin of the bats, causing them to wake up and go through their fat reserves entirely before the end of the winter.
And Kevin, I want to bring you on this in on this as well. But so, Jeff, just as we talk about the particular problem with white nose is it attacks the bats during the wintertime when they should be sleeping, basically. If they were hit with white nose syndrome in the summertime, would they be as affected or would they be able to shake it off?
So it turns out that they're able to completely fight off the fungus in the summer. In fact, when we look for the fungus in the summer, by the end of the summer, there's no detectable amounts of the fungus on any bats that we look at.
Wow. Kevin, jump in on here. I'd love to hear what
Sure.
you're learning about white nose and why the bat's incredible immune system doesn't seem to help them with this in the wintertime.
Yeah, I think Jeff explained it really well that, you know, it's you're hitting them when they're down, right, when their immune system's on this low simmer.
Right.
But compounded with that, interestingly, it's kind of this double whammy because the fungus, Pseudogymnoscus destructans, only grows really well in the cold temperatures. So, you know, there have been laboratory studies where we've looked at different temperatures and the growth curves for this fungus, and it seems to just thrive and multiply actually during those colder hibernation temperatures.
And
so
it's sort of,
you know, in the summer, it's not growing quite well, but in the winter, when it's growing best and when the immune systems of the bats are sort of at the lowest, is where this pathogen really has its prime opportunity.
So even though they have these incredible immune systems, Kevin, the immune system is down in the wintertime, and that's why they fall prey to white nose.
Yeah, that's the theory. And, you know, I think, you know, the jury is still a little bit out on exactly how special their immune systems are, bats as a whole. But clearly, they are important reservoirs for a number of these emerging diseases that affect humans, and that's very clear. And so really all these studies that are delving into the bat immune system are going to be critical over the next 5 or 10 years.
Well, I definitely want to ask both of you guys about that. Let me also invite our listeners, though, to join us, 1-800-892-6477, 1-800-892-NHPR. Again, today in The Exchange, it's a two-part show. We talked earlier about the impact of this huge storm we're seeing in New England, and NHPR will be following that all day, of course, for you. But right now, we're looking at some exciting new research about bats and their immune systems, what this might teach us about human disease, also why bats have been having so much trouble with something called white nose syndrome. Let's hear from you. Your questions and comments are welcome at 1-800-892-6477, 1-800-892-NHPR. Send us an email, exchange@nhpr.org. Find us on Facebook or Twitter. Again, the number 1-800-892-6477. And before we get to, guys, both of you, the idea that bats' immune systems can maybe help us combat diseases that affect human beings. Jeff, I know you like to remind people that even though they may think bats are creepy, they have a huge ecological and economic impact on us here in the Granite State and in New England.
Yeah, so it's been recently estimated that bats provide what we call ecosystem services, and so things that we don't normally think about but are really important to our everyday lives. And the biggest thing is that they provide they're a major insectivore, and so they eat a lot of our insect pests. And so they're out there flying around. Many people are certainly familiar in New Hampshire with mosquitoes. They do eat tons and tons of mosquitoes a year. but they also eat major pests of agriculture and of our forests as well. And so they're out there flying and eating the moss that we're so worried about defoliating various plants that we value.
So all the nasty bugs and insects that are carrying diseases and hurting crops, bats are chomping on those.
They are, and the estimated amounts are in the billions of dollars a year that bats save to our economy. And so they provide a really useful and valuable benefit.
Wow, billions of dollars. Do you think people, Kevin, appreciate the economic impact of something that they really don't want flying around their house?
I don't think they do. You know, I think a lot of people just really aren't aware of how valuable bats are. And when you put a dollar value on that, it really gets people's attention, right? And that, you know, if we didn't have bats around, how many billions or millions and millions of dollars would we have to use on pesticides to spray our corn crops in the Midwest because all the moths that eat those corn crops are still around. So, yeah, I think when you start to put dollar values on it, it gets people's attention, and I think it's a great argument. I'll just add one thing. There's also a large group of bats that feed on fruit and also pollen and nectar, and so there's this whole other group of bats, especially in the tropics, that provide another ecosystem service, which is essentially pollinating crops and dispersing seeds throughout the forest. So they help with forest regeneration and even crops which for some are important, like tequila. Tequila is primarily a bat-pollinated cactus, which is an interesting little fact.
Wow. So if you like margaritas, support bat research.
That's right.
I did not know that, Kevin. You learn something new every day. So what about, Kevin, droppings? You mentioned, some feed off of fruits, and so they're pollinating there, and some eat insects, which we all know about the benefits of that. But birds, we often hear, are helpful because of their droppings. What about bats?
Mm-hmm. Sure, yeah, bats, same thing, especially for the fruit-eating bats. When they poop as they're flying around, they're spreading seeds, so they're helping regenerate these plants. And, of course, bat guano from insect-feeding bats is used in many countries as fertilizer for crops. So people go into caves, harvest the guano, and put that on their food crops.
All right, gentlemen, we've got some listeners who want to join our conversation. Again, your questions and comments about what's happening with the bats in our part of the country. Also, new research on bats' immune systems. 1-800-892-6477 is our number. Email exchange at nhpr.org. And let's go first to Concord, where Doreen's on the line. Hi, Doreen. Go ahead. You're on the exchange.
Thank you for taking my call. Hi. In the 80s, I lived in southeastern Massachusetts on Mount Hope Bay, and I knew the late anthropologist and veterinarian Elizabeth Atwood from Tufts. And we had a conversation one time about the spraying that was going on because of equine encephalitis outbreak, and she noticed a dramatic effect on the bat population after that spraying. And I'm wondering if since then there's been any research on the effects of that spraying on bats, and if the spraying that we're doing now might have be supporting some of the diseases that we're seeing in bats.
Wow, Doreen, great question. Kevin, Jeff, can you answer that one? The spraying we do for insects, is that hurting bats?
Or Kevin, not any research that I'm familiar with, but certainly aquatic insects, of which mosquitoes would be, are a big part of bat diets. It all depends on exactly where you're finding the bats. And so, but aquatic insects, and so insects that are emerging from our waterways, are a big part of bat diets in particular areas, and they would definitely be affected by spraying in those areas.
Okay, thank you for the question, Doreen. We'll take more of your questions and comments in just a moment. The exchange number is 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange at nhpr.org. Keep it right here. This This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Stay with NHPR all day for information about the storm that's hitting us here in New England. We talked about that earlier in the hour on The Exchange, and we'll give you an update in about 20 minutes. Right now, though, we're finding out more about some exciting new research about bats, their incredible immune systems, what this might teach us about human disease. We've also, though, been talking about the struggles of bats in this part of the country, still decimated by white nose syndrome. We have two researchers with us, Jeff Foster, an assistant professor of genetics at UNH, and Kevin Olival, senior research scientist and bat expert with Eco Health Alliance. Again, the number for you to join us, 1-800-892-6477. And Josh joins us from Plymouth. Hi, Josh. You're on The Exchange. Thanks for calling in.
Hey, good morning.
Morning.
Yeah, no, I just had a question. I was wondering if environmental changes or human activities impact this fungus on the bats, or if it's something that might have occurred anyways, you know what I mean?
Yeah, it's a great question. Thank you very much, Josh. All right, so Jeff, do you want to take that one? Climate change, disruptions in habitat, human activity causing white nose syndrome among bats.
Yeah, it's an unanswered question right now, but certainly, so we know that the fungus is abundant throughout Eurasia, well, particularly in Europe, and so just about every place our colleagues have looked for the fungus, they've found it on bats hibernating throughout Europe. And there's some initial suggestions that it goes as far east and into China. And so it's certainly a common fungus of bats throughout Europe, and the fungus does not kill them there. And so it appears that the bats there have evolved a resistance to the fungus itself. And we also can look at the genetics of the fungus there, and it's really, really diverse fungus throughout Europe, strongly suggesting that the fungus has been there for thousands of years, and that's our best guess.
Wow. So, Jeff, let me just jump in, if I could, to clarify. So European bats are getting white nose, too, but they're not dying from it?
Right. And so you can go out into European caves. You'll see the telltale kind of fungal, white fungal growth on their faces and on their wings, but it's not killing the bats there.
Wow. Kevin, what do you pull out of that? That's really interesting.
Yeah, that is the story. And the interesting thing, I think the listener's question was right on in that, what are we doing to the environment? And so white nose syndrome is an example of an introduced disease. I mean, based on the evidence that Jeff just explained, we're everywhere we look in Europe, we found it. We know that it just arrived in the U.S. around 2006. And so this was brought over by people. And so, you know, people not cleaning their gear, maybe going into caves in Europe and bringing this back. We don't know who did it. It was just maybe some tourist, maybe some, could have been anybody. But it most likely was a human being who brought the fungus to the United States. And so I think this is a general trend, something we're very interested in at EcoHealth, is this idea of how do human impact on the environment, different things that we're doing to increasing our travel and trade and globalization, the deforestation and hunting of animals. How do all these things link in with emerging diseases, both that affect the wildlife, but also that affect humans?
So more often than not,
what we're seeing is, you know, humans are doing things to the environment that are actually causing us to get exposed to these new diseases like Ebola virus or SARS virus. And it's this unnatural phenomena that we're creating that's really allowing these diseases to jump from the wildlife population into humans.
Can we conclude, Kevin, then, that European bats have just developed a resistance to this because they've been dealing with it longer, and that American bats haven't developed that resistance yet?
I think that's a valid theory, yeah. I think that, you know, they've been exposed to it for a long time. And I think Jeff probably, I know Jeff's done some more research on this, but he might want to comment more. But absolutely, this idea of genetically some sort of immunity that is likely genetic and passed on, these bats in Europe may have, that the North American bats do not yet have that resistance.
Well, here's an email from Ellen in Manchester who says, bats have been around for a very long time. Have there ever been these large die-offs from disease in the past? And Ellen says, why is this happening now? So, Jeff, why don't you take that one?
Sure. Sure, that is definitely something we're interested in. And so if, for example, as we hypothesize that bats in Europe have evolved a resistance, there may have been large die-offs in the past in Europe. And so we can, this is something we're certainly interested in pursuing in the future, is look at bat populations in Europe and see if we can genetically detect if there's been any kind of signal that there have been major die-offs. And you can also try to look in the fossil record, particularly kind of going through sediments of caves, to see if there are any major detections of any major die-off events. And so those two things are kind of future planned projects that would shed some light, hopefully, on the likelihood that there were major die-offs in the past. That would be in Europe. There's been no known major die-offs of bats in North America. And so that's what makes this fungus so unusual. And, you know, we've been talking about how bats really have these amazing immune systems, and it's only when they are faced with a fungus that really is able to exploit kind of the weakness of their immune system is it able to have such a big effect.
Well, Ellen, thanks for that email. And you can email us, too, at exchange@nhpr.org. Find us on Facebook or Twitter. Give us a call, 1-800-892-6477. Suzanne's in Kittery. Hi, Suzanne. Go ahead. You're on the air.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
About 2 years ago, my mother was renting an apartment in Concord. And in a space of about 2 months, at least three occasions, bats were in the house and we were trying to get rid of them. We fixed the chimney, but before that, when they're flying around, how do you get them out? We opened the windows and we were swatting at them, and a veterinarian told us don't touch them because they're rabid. And what do you do with bats in the house?
Yeah, and yet you know they're useful, so you maybe don't want to kill them, Suzanne,
right,
but you definitely
right.
don't want them flying around. I hear you. Thank you so much for the call. Kevin, I'm guessing a lot of listeners have that question. Okay, I appreciate what the bats do
sure.
for the environment and the ecosystem and so forth, but I really don't want it in my house.
Yeah, it's pretty common to get a wayward bat that, you know, finds his way in and he might get stuck in the house. And they're not always rabid, but that is a concern. And so, you know, more often than not, they're not going to have rabies. It's a very low percentage of bats that have rabies, I think less than 1%. And so, you know, there is always the risk there. So we always suggest that, no, do not handle the bat, especially with your bare hands. You know, we recommend basically you would contact your local wildlife authority or your local animal authority to help you out with that situation.
Although usually it happens in the middle of the night.
Yeah, well, that is a problem. I mean,
it sounds good in theory, but
I think opening the windows and trying to, you know, sort of usher the bat out of the window is a good way to go about, as the listener was suggesting.
Well,
again, you don't want to grab the animal with your bare hand just in case you do happen to get bit.
If you're my parents, you may call me. And so they recently had a big brown bat. They live in Sunapee, New Hampshire.
Uh-huh.
And they had a big brown bat in their house. And I have been rabies vaccinated, and so I ushered it outside.
Well, but
there you go. Get to know a bat biologist. That's
yeah, Jeff, you can start a little side business there, right?
Yeah.
But Suzanne, I appreciate the call. And, you know, she mentioned being afraid that bats are rabid, and I'm sure many people have that concern, Jeff. And also for you, Jeff, Kevin mentioned earlier, okay, bats are reservoirs, as biologists put it, for diseases like SARS, like Ebola. I mean, who wants to go near these things if they've got Ebola?
Yeah, and so I think it's a key point that if you are faced with that type of situation, you really call in a professional who can help you with it. And so there are lots of licensed wildlife professionals who can best of all exclude bats. You don't want to do it while they have their pups, and so you have to make sure that you don't do that. But at those times of the year where you can really go in and exclude bats from coming into your house, and so there's various ways that you can seal off kind of the cracks and crevices of your house to prevent them from coming in the first place.
Well, and about that idea, Jeff, that bats are reservoirs for viruses, even though they, with these incredible immune systems. What are the implications for the study of diseases that affect humans, given what we know about how great the bats are at warding off disease?
Yeah, Kevin, maybe you want to field that since it's his expertise.
That's Kevin's field. Okay,
sure.
Go ahead, Kevin.
Sure. So we are finding a large number of these viruses all around the world. And so I guess I'll first caution that it's not to say, we're not saying that any bats in North America might carry Ebola virus. So these are, some of the bats in Africa where Ebola outbreaks have occurred. There's evidence that they carry Ebola and Ebola-like viruses. And so there's, these sort of geographic patterns to disease, just like there are geographic patterns to human culture and everything else. Where, certain diseases are found in certain pockets in wildlife all around the world. And so, we have a number of large studies where we're looking in not only bats, but bats, rodents, primates, shrews, all sorts of mammals around the world, and looking at all the viruses they may carry. And so there is this huge diversity of viruses in the natural world, I would say. And I think really the key in linking these things and linking together conservation and all these new studies on disease is understanding what are the real factors that are causing diseases to jump into people. It's not just that they're out there, that these diseases are in the natural wildlife populations. It's we're doing something to the environment, or somehow we're coming into contact with these animals that we weren't in contact with before. And so really trying to tease out those precise human behaviors and those precise ecological factors that are causing diseases to jump. And so that's really, I think, the big concern and the big future push that we need to be working towards.
Let's take another call. This is Hector in Wolfboro. Hi, Hector. You're on The Exchange. Thanks for calling in.
Yes, good morning. Thanks for taking my call from sunny Wolfboro. I understand that some species of bats migrate. If they're diseased, do they possibly spread it to other bats in other areas?
Thanks for the call, Hector. Do you want to comment on that, Jeff?
Sure. That's a great question, and it's the major reason why we think the fungus has spread so rapidly across North America. So it was initially detected in near Albany, New York in 2006, and since then has likely killed more than 6 million bats and has spread to 25 states and 5 or 6 Canadian provinces. And so it's really spread very quickly. And it's spread so fast, and our genetic signatures that we're looking at strongly suggest that bats are moving it indeed long, long distances on the order of hundreds of miles. And so definitely their migration patterns and just simply their movement patterns throughout the year are undeniably spreading the fungus long distances and has really allowed it to spread all the way from New York up into the Maritimes in Canada and all the way west to west of the Mississippi to states such as, Iowa, Missouri, and Arkansas.
Jeff, one of you mentioned that there are many, many species of bats. Is white-nose syndrome affecting, one species in particular or several different species or all species?
So it's affecting primarily our 6 species of bats, and they're the species of bats that are living in caves primarily in the eastern United States. And so, it's only a handful of species, but it's really, really impacting those species. And so we'll have declines at a particular cave of 99%. And so 99% of the bats that were there are no longer at a particular hibernating place. And so those are major, major decimations of populations.
Well, and here's another email from David in Amherst. He says, is it helpful to support bat survival to set up a bat house outside my house or not? David says, if so, any guidelines on building them? Glad you emailed, David, because, Kevin, at my old house, we had a bat house outside, and we never saw bats in them. They came into our house a couple times, but we peeked in the bat house a bunch of times and never saw anything in there. So they seemed to like our house better than the bat house. So, David, thank you.
That's where the specs and where you put them and how you build them, I think, comes into handy. And there are lots of great resources on the Internet. I believe, Bat Conservation International will have some guidelines on that. But there are absolutely you should build a bat house. I think every, you know, providing more habitat is better than, you know, as habitat around the world is diminishing, the more that we can do to help is definitely worthwhile. And so bat houses are great. Bats will use them. Not always, but sometimes, you know, bats will find them and use them. And it's great to provide that habitat for them.
Maybe they didn't like the wallpaper that we put up. I'm not really sure why they didn't go in there. So, gentlemen, so much more that we could talk about. But, Kevin, just to finish off with you, if I could. So what more do you think we need to know? What would you love to just discover, like, right now about bats that you don't know now?
Oh, wow. Great question. You know, we started off talking about the immune system of bats. And so I think, you know, that really is a ripe area for exploration. I think, you know, the work that Jeff is doing with white nose syndrome and the research community, the more we know about the immune system and its link with white nose will help us understand that problem as well. You know, I think bats are fascinating and have been an understudied group for a long time. They're sort of these nocturnal, cryptic creatures that, you know, a very small community of researchers was interested, say, 20, 30 years ago. Now there's growing interest because of some of these links with white nose and with emerging diseases. But I think there's so much more for us to learn, and I think it's just a great – I love studying bats, and I think it's a great field.
Jeff, how about you, real quick?
Yeah, I'm definitely interested in – there is a glimmer of hope here, particularly for bats in the Northeast, and so we have – some kind of pockets of individuals that may be resistant to the disease. We don't know that for sure, but investigating both the genetics and environmental factors that may be enabling these pockets of survivors to persist and maybe be the seeds of our future bat populations is certainly an interesting area of research.
All right. Well, Jeff, thank you very much for being with us. We really appreciate it. We'll call you the next time there's a bat in the house.
Alrighty.
That's Jeff Foster, Assistant Professor of Genetics at UNH. You too, Kevin Olival, thank you very much for being with us.
Thank you, Laura. Pleasure.
Kevin Olival, Senior Research Scientist and Bat Expert with EcoHealth Alliance. The Exchange is a production of NHPR, and stay with NHPR all day. We'll be covering the storm, how it's affecting New Hampshire and New England. We'll have a little bit more information for you tomorrow on The Exchange, but NHPR will be on this story all day long, so keep it right here. This is The Exchange on NHPR.